Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Practice Groups, was recorded on Tuesday, May 2, 2017, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. We're very pleased to welcome to our call today two guests, author J.D. Vance. He's the author of Hillbilly Elegy, and he's also a principal at the Mithril Capital Management, LLC. He's going to be interviewed, for all intents and purposes, by Adam J. White, a return guest to Teleform. He's a research fellow at the Hoover Institute Institution and an adjunct professor at the Antonin Scalia Law School at George Mason University right here in the Washington, D.C. area. As I mentioned, we're going to proceed sort of in an interview format, but ultimately we'll be looking to the audience for your questions, so please be thinking of those for when we get to that portion of the program. With that, Adam White, please lead us forward.
Well, thanks, Dean. Thanks, J.D., and thanks, everybody, for joining us today. I have to admit, it was a real pleasure not just to have this conversation today, but to read the book in the first place. I first met J.D. a few years ago at a policy conference, and as we were just chit-chatting, and I asked what he was up to those days, he said he was working on a book, and he described it to me, and it sounded interesting, but I have to admit, I never imagined that it would turn into the significant publishing event that it proved to be last year in the middle of a chaotic election year. As many of you may know, perhaps it's why you called in to listen, J.D.'s book, Hillbilly Elegy, tells a story of family breakdown, but also family coming together and succeeding, and an individual, J.D., succeeding at home and then through a series of institutions that helped put him where he is today. It's a fascinating story with parallels to other important books that I'd like to draw comparisons to. But before we get into the book, J.D., Dean introduced you. He said you're at Mithril Capital, but you recently relocated, a homecoming of sorts, right?
Yeah, that's right. Well, thanks, Adam, and thanks, Dean, for having me, and to everybody listening. I'm looking forward to this and looking forward to the conversation. But yeah, you're right, Adam. I did actually recently relocate to Ohio. The sort of, you know, broad geographic idea is that I've always wanted to move home, and so I was really just looking for an opportunity to do it. And the book really gave me an opportunity in the sense that, you know, one, it gave me, I think, a platform to work on and to think about some of the issues that I'm most worried about. You know, but also the good thing about investing is that you can do it from a lot of different places. And I found a way to work with Steve Case on the Rise of the Rest initiative, which is in short an effort to try to bring more venture capital and more technology investment to areas of the country where we think there are good business opportunities, but there may not be quite as much venture capital. So that's why I moved home, and that's what I'm working on. And, you know, it's good to be back. So I'm calling you right now from Columbus, Ohio, which is certainly not where I thought I'd be sitting this time last year.
Well, we'll get back to that and what's brought you back to Ohio. But let's start with first things first. Why don't you tell us about the book?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. So the book is encapsulated in some ways by the subtitle, A Memoir of a Family and a Culture in Crisis. And so the family element of it is that it is a very personal story of my grandparents, my parents, and myself, and how we sort of traversed the past 40 or 50 years of what folks look at and think is the American dream, which in a lot of ways it is. Of course, the short version of my story is that I came from a pretty poor family, a lot of chaos, a lot of domestic instability, and I went to Yale Law School and became an investor and now have a happy family with a baby on the way. But if you really look at the long version of the story, you see that the arc is one of incredibly uneven progress, where my grandparents did very well for a time, but then not especially well, where the steel town that they had migrated to from eastern Kentucky coal country started to really struggle with some of the post-industrial problems that really drove the Trump nomination and eventually the Trump election. And of course, you know, my family struggled with a lot of the things that I think are relatively well known to those who study lower income folks: family instability, addiction, divorce, trauma, poverty, the whole nine yards of sort of what folks expect when they see a family like mine. You know, a lot of that is something that I experienced. And so what I try to do with the book is simultaneously set the context, and this is where the culture in crisis part of it comes in. But I truly try to set contextually that this is a story that is relatively broadly replicated across the white working class in the United States, especially the white working class in the region of the country that I'm writing about, which is Appalachia, the industrial Midwest, and the Southeast. And so what I also try to do is actually try to, you know, create some identifiability with the characters. I try to explain them and describe them in the complex ways that they actually exist, because of course they're not just characters to me. They're my family, they're my friends, and they're me personally. And so, you know, what I really try to do here is in some ways explain and describe a relatively well accepted and well known social problem, but at the same time to really thickly give a description that allows people to empathize with the characters and understand what some of these sociological problems feel like when you are confronted with them very personally. Another way I think of looking at my book is that I'm trying to answer in a very personal way why we don't have more upward mobility in the United States, right? And there are some debates about, you know, whether upward mobility has actually declined, whether it's stagnated, whether it's basically the same way that it was 50 or so years ago. And I don't really, you know, touch on that debate so much. I think it's much more of a data-driven analysis. But what I do try to understand and try to frame is why in certain regions of the country where we do see lower upward mobility, why that might be the case. And I think it's a complicated combination of factors that has to do with the regional economy. It has to do with education and human capital development. It has to do with social capital that exists in families that have been hit pretty hard by an economic crisis. But it also has to do, I think, with the decline of faith and civic and community institutions that exist in some of these families. And so the I think ultimate thesis of the book is that this is really complicated, that if we're looking to Utah and we see a veritable land of opportunity where no matter where you're born on the socioeconomic ladder, you're very likely to do well, but you look to the industrial Midwest and you see that a lot of children who are born at the bottom or even the middle aren't doing much better than their parents, I try to really understand why that's happening. And of course, I do that in a very personal way because that's how I experienced it. Now, the final thing that I'll say is that, you know, though the book is not primarily a sociological or an economic treatise, I do hope that readers who come at it hoping to get a good story also see that it's not just a good story, that I do try to contextualize this information with enough economic and sociological data such that people appreciate that the problems that I'm writing about are not just the problems of my family, but like I said earlier, are the problems that are shared relatively broadly across the culture. So with that, I'll shut up.
Well, I don't want to give away too much of the narrative of the book because, after all, I hope listeners will consider buying it. It's for sale at all Amazon and other fine booksellers. But if you wouldn't mind giving us a couple of examples of some of the episodes or sort of stories in the book, that, because as you said, the book and the story serves as sort of a microcosm for broader national concerns about family breakdown and economic immobility.
Sure. Well, you know, one of the things, I'll give a couple of examples. So the first is very relevant to this issue of family instability and trauma and the way that it replicates itself over the generations. And so what in some ways I'm really trying to do here is highlight what folks commonly call culture and to really start a discussion about what is it that we mean when we say that a kid is born into a culture that maybe has some problems, and is that fundamentally a problem of the kid who's born inside of it? Is it fundamentally a problem of the parents who are bringing their kids up in that environment? Or is it a much broader phenomenon, something that replicates itself and is in some ways very difficult to identify the single bad actor who really made this all happen? And so, you know, one of the stories that I tell in my book is of the first time that we really encountered the child welfare system. And what happened is that I was in a car riding with my mother, and she lost her temper and eventually threatened some measure of violence, and the car stopped, and I ran to a stranger's house, and that stranger called the police, and eventually I was, you know, sort of, I found myself in the back of a cop cruiser. My mom was arrested, and like I said, the state had now entered our family life as an actor. And so in some ways, it's very easy to empathize with the situation facing the child welfare agents, right? They're asking really pertinent questions about my mental and physical health. They're trying to find out what's going on in our family. And they're all really well-meaning people who are trying to help us. But at the same time, that intrusion by the state into our family life means that I have a sort of more precarious relationship with my grandparents. And my grandparents, at this point in the story and really through my entire life, are the most positive and most stable actors in my family and in my life. But the thing that I'm effectively faced with when this bureaucracy has entered my life is a question of, do I keep on telling them the truth? Do I keep on explaining what's been going on in my home? If yes, then I might find myself in a foster care situation. I might find myself ripped from the arms of my grandparents and from the family situation that has been most sustaining and most stable for me. If I answer no, then I don't get any help from the state welfare agency for myself or for my family, but I at least get them out of my hair. And so I decided to effectively lie to them to restate and reformulate what had been happening in my family life. And they eventually go away. And luckily my grandma was such an incredibly positive factor in my life that she continued to be an outsized role player, and things eventually worked out for me. But the point of the story is that when you have this remarkably multi-generational family trauma, it's both incredibly hard for the families and the children who are dealing with it, and there isn't really an obvious way out, at least not one that exists in current sort of public policy and civic policy. So that was the lesson that I took from that situation is, you know, you shut up when the child welfare agents come into your life. And frankly, there are a lot of child welfare agents and a lot of children who are in abusive or neglectful homes who are having that exact same conversation, unfortunately, as we speak. So that's one story where I try to highlight, you know, again, one of these broader sociological things that's happening to families like mine. The second way that I'll highlight this is that I tell a story in the book about the first time that I ever had a truly fancy dinner. And in some ways it's a funny story because I have no idea what I'm doing. I remember that the woman who was passing around wine before the dinner at sort of a cocktail reception, you know, she asked me if I wanted white wine, and I said, sure, I'll take some. And then she asked, do you want Sauvignon Blanc or Chardonnay? And I actually had no idea what she meant and thought she might have even been screwing with me, before using my powers of deduction to realize that she actually was just talking about two separate types of white wine. And, you know, really the entire dinner was this constant exercise in realizing that I had no idea what to do. I, you know, there were too many utensils at the dinner table. I didn't know what to do with them. So I excused myself to the restroom and called my girlfriend. I was a little bit, you know, unfamiliar with just the social networking aspect of an event like that. And so it was a little uncomfortable there. And the point of that, even though it's obviously a pretty humorous story and that, you know, things went ultimately very well for me, is that we talk about, you know, we talk about, or we don't have to often talk about social capital, I think, in a way that's reflective of the way that a lot of children actually experience it, which is that it takes a fair amount of institutional knowledge to know what to do in some of these environments. And sometimes you're just at a dinner and you don't know what you're doing, but sometimes you're not sure how to ask for a recommendation letter. Sometimes you're not sure how to ask for an introduction to a job or a hiring partner. You know, these things actually create obvious and in some ways measurable disadvantages for children who grow up in families like mine. And so again, I'm sort of trying to walk people through a very personal narrative, but one that implicates a much broader sociological trend.
Now, the story about the dinner, the wine, I remember that because that was, if I remember correctly, correct me if I'm wrong, but that was the dinner was a law firm recruitment dinner, right?
That's correct.
You had, and that's sort of the other part of the story, is that you were, you know, where there was family breakdown in your immediate family, you were aided not just by, in the first instance, extended family, but then as you sort of moved on from your town and grew up, you worked your way through a number of institutions where you learned a lot, or you acquired a lot of this social capital, right? There was a prominent law school, a law firm, the Army, right? And why don't you tell us about that part of your life and how that affected you?
Sure. Well, yeah, that's absolutely right. And in some ways, the story of my life is how I just over time progressively earned more and more social capital largely through the channels of people who were just very nice to me and very good to me. It's interesting, of course, that I'm talking to the Federalist Society, which, of course, I was a member of when I was in law school, and still, I believe, a card-carrying member of the Federalist Society. But it was a really important way to create and sort of replicate social capital, because a lot of the kids who were in the Federalist Society were not like me. They actually knew their way around the law school. They knew their way around some of these social environments and hiring events and so forth. And they were, of course, very willing to help out and to lend a helping hand, even if that helping hand was just, hey, this is how you should conduct yourself in some of these professional environments. So that was very helpful for me. And yeah, you mentioned the military, which was another really important institution that, that played a positive role in my life. Now, it was the Marine Corps, unfortunately, so I have to correct you there.
Oh,
but
sorry.
No worries. But the Marine Corps, which I think from the outside folks think of as this institution that trains people how to fight, it gives them a gun, it of course has an important role in winning America's military conflicts. But what it really does, in addition to that, obviously it does that, but it also creates a remarkable amount of soft skills, or what James Heckman might call non-cognitive skills, in kids who came from backgrounds like the one that I came from. Because it wasn't just that I learned how to shoot a gun in the Marine Corps, but I also learned how to balance a checkbook. I learned how to iron a professional uniform. I learned how to show up to work on time. I learned how to manage conflict and disagree in a professional environment in a way that was productive, as opposed to a way that just made the problem worse. And so all of these things really combined to create, in some ways, the skills that successful professional adults need, but I just didn't have when I was a kid. I remember the first time I ever went to buy a car was in the United States Marine Corps, and I went to go and I was going to accept the dealer's offered interest rate, which I believe was 20.9% at the time. And it was a Marine Corps gunnery sergeant who stepped in and said, JD, stop being an idiot. You go and shop for loans when you get into a situation like this. And then he actually ordered another Marine to take me to the local credit union, where I got a much better deal and learned not just how to shop for a loan, but of course avoided a pretty significant financial mistake in the process. So it really is amazing how these institutions all sort of worked for me. The nuclear family fell apart for me, but the extended network of family didn't. My high school was pretty effective at helping me. The Marine Corps was just an unbelievably positive influence on my life. And then, of course, in college and law school, I continued to sort of, hit the proverbial jackpot. But, one thing that occurs to me just talking about it, and of course, I think this is one of the points of the book, is that when you live in an area where a lot of these civic institutions and a lot of these economic institutions have completely disappeared or have largely started to falter, you have a situation where kids growing up in those circumstances have to get pretty lucky. And it's not a luck that's necessarily super easy to replicate through public policy, but it is certainly luck, and that's definitely one of the lessons I think I take away from my own upbringing.
And I don't want to monopolize the time. We'll turn it over to audience questions in just a couple minutes, but I want to focus in on this point about institutions, because the last time you and I had an event on the book, I think we talked about it a bit, and I've been pondering it since. I mean, as a conservative, I tend to think of myself as an individual and as an individualist. But I think your book's a reminder that institutions are important, and in your case, it was a mix of both private institutions, but also public institutions. This year is the 60th anniversary, I guess, of Samuel Huntington's original book article on conservatism, where he said that, and this is back in 57, he says a conservative is somebody who believes in institutions, who believes in safeguarding institutions. And I wonder, to try to draw some of the themes of your book to modern policy debates, do you think that conservatives or the nation as a whole is concerned enough with institutions or too little?
Well, I worry that it's concerned way too little with institutions. And, you and I share a lot of political viewpoints and a lot of ideological priors. But I do think that we tend to have a tendency in the conversation to focus either too much on the state or too much on the individual. We're very comfortable with talking about the ways in which individuals should make their lives better, the ways in which economic incentives can be directed in a way that encourages people to make better decisions and so forth. And we're also very comfortable talking about the government and how it either promotes or inhibits upward mobility or opportunity, about how it promotes or inhibits job growth, about how the tax code is either good or bad from the perspective of creating more economic opportunities. But there are, of course, all of these Burkean mediating institutions in the middle that are incredibly important and play an incredibly important role in whether people have not just upwardly mobile lives like I did, but, you know, just happy lives. You know, the life of a person is not just in their own little family and in their own little world, and it's not just when they go to work. It's about churches and community activism and the institutions that exist between the state and the individual. And I do worry at a very fundamental level that we've just lost the ability to talk about those problems and to talk about those institutions. Now, you know, one of the things that always brings this to mind to me is the debate over school reform in the United States. And, you know, we typically have a pretty standard left-right paradigm where folks on the left argue that we should have more public funding, perhaps more strengthening of teachers' unions, but certainly more strengthening of public institutions in our provision of education. And then conservatives very often talk about school vouchers or involving more private parties or private dollars or enabling school choice in the function of our education system. But, you know, when I think back to my own education and to why I was not being especially successful, and frankly, when I talk to educators on the ground today about the things that really need to change, it's very often the problem is not that we have really bad schools or that we need to fix our public schools or divert more resources to private schools. Very often the problem is that we have incredibly bad, we have incredibly deficient children in one form or another. And I don't mean deficient in a way that we should judge them morally. I mean that very often you have kids who can't read coming into kindergarten or first grade, kids who don't even know the alphabet coming into kindergarten or first grade. Very often you have kids coming to school who are remarkably traumatized and really struggle in a number of ways completely apart and different and not amenable to state intervention. And that is something that we're just not comfortable talking about. And I worry that unless we get that part right, unless we figure out the family, both the nuclear family and the extended network of family, unless we're more comfortable talking about community groups and churches and so forth, we're never going to get this issue right, because, you know, we can't just pretend that everything is about the individual, everything is about the state. There are, in fact, a lot of things that exist in the middle.
And just two last points. Another point that crops up in your book is mobility. And I don't mean social mobility exclusively. I actually mean geographic mobility. You grew up, you know, not just in one town, but in a broader region, right, of Ohio and Kentucky. And you moved back and forth a couple of times. And I'm wondering, do you think there's enough geographic mobility today and ability and willingness of people to move to where economic opportunity is? I mean, recognizing, of course, that geographic mobility also has costs in terms of undermining family cohesion. But what are your thoughts on that?
Sure. Well, yeah, I think it's very complicated. And, you know, my top line thoughts are that we definitely don't have as much geographic mobility as we should among probably the bottom half of the workforce. And, you know, what I mean is that you have a lot of areas in the United States where you have relatively low unemployment, rising wages, and so forth. Very often those are clustered around, you know, relatively dense urban areas or suburban areas, but you don't have nearly as much mobility from really high unemployment areas to some of these low unemployment areas. That's something, of course, that, you know, economists have worried about now for 30 or 40 years, the fact that we have much, much less geographic mobility. It seems like each decade has less geographic mobility than the decade before it. And that, of course, is in some ways not totally in conformity with our notion of ourselves as a very mobile society. It's the sort of place where people will pack up and move and go wherever opportunity needs to take them. You know, the flip side of it, like you said, is that mobility is a double-edged sword. It's not just that people can go to these areas that have more job prospects and more employment prospects, find themselves a good job, and everything works out fine. Very often, what mobility does is really stretch the family system and the family unit. And that is, in some cases, a story that my family knows pretty well. You know, the issue is that we have such broad differences in the regional economic opportunities that exist that mobility, I think, probably in the 21st century is a greater stress than it was maybe when my grandparents moved from Eastern Kentucky to Southern Ohio. You know, when they made that move from Eastern Kentucky to Southern Ohio, they could still drive back and see their family every weekend, and they still had a really engaged relationship with their extended kinship network. If you talk about moving from, let's say, Eastern Kentucky to Denver, Colorado, or Eastern Kentucky to Phoenix, Arizona, obviously that creates a lot of stressors that weren't necessarily present 40 or 50 years ago. And so I don't necessarily think that geographic mobility is a panacea, but all things being equal, it would probably be much better for our labor force, and especially for working class Americans, if there was a little bit more movement between, you know, one geographic area that doesn't have a lot of opportunity and to another geographic area that does have a lot of that opportunity. Now, you know, of course, the final thing I'll say about this is that this question of mobility and why there isn't as much of it is incredibly complicated. And I probably have spent more time than anyone should trying to understand why. There's some evidence that, you know, the opportunity costs of not moving are lower, and consequently that means people are staying put. There's some evidence that the sort of benefits of job transitions has become lower, especially for those at the bottom half of the workforce. And that, of course, means you're going to have fewer people switching jobs and consequently fewer people moving because of it. I think that housing policy is an incredibly important part of this. It's nice to say that everyone should pack up and move to San Francisco, but San Francisco housing policy is such a nightmare that no one but the very wealthy can really afford a house within the city limits. And so, you know, there are all of these complex factors that work together that make it really hard for lower income and working class Americans to move from one area to another. But, you know, that doesn't mean that we should not be thinking about it or not be worrying about it, because it is, I believe, one of the biggest drivers of the fact that we don't have a super dynamic workforce, and consequently we don't have a whole lot of opportunity among the lower class.
I mean, we have seen, and Michael Barone has written a great book on this, on patterns of migration in the United States. You know, we've seen moments of immense migration, right? I mean, my own family roots, you know, I'm from Iowa, but generations ago my family hopped on a train from upstate New York, and a generation before that they came from Germany. And generations after that, you have people from the Midwest moving all the way out to California, right, and even helping to co-found you know, modern Silicon Valley and so on. So it's, you know, it's a familiar story. I mean, I could ask about the reception that your book received during the election year and how it maps on to the Trump phenomenon. But honestly, I think it'd probably be best at this point to turn the microphone over to audience members for a question. So Dean, would you mind giving the instructions?
Sure, of course. The floor mode is already on, so you won't hear the automated announcement you ordinarily hear. But if you have a question for our guest, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. The floor mode is already on. All you need to do is push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We'll get to your questions momentarily. Let me make a quick commercial announcement, if I could indulge. The next scheduled Teleform conference call is Thursday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, when we'll be talking about the False Claims Act. That's Thursday at 1. But also just a general reminder to check the Federal Society's website and monitor your emails for other calls as they're scheduled. We're in that season when we're expecting a lot of Supreme Court opinions, decisions coming out. So we'll have a lot of sort of last-minute Teleform conference calls being scheduled. Again today, author J.D. Vance, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Adam, it looks like we've got 5 questions to begin to get us started, so let's go to our first caller.
Hi, this is Roger Clegg at the Center for Equal Opportunity. Thank you very much, Mr. Vance, for your presentation and for your book. I wanted to ask you to elaborate, if you would, on the importance of family structure. One of the things that we've looked at a lot over the years is how just about every social pathology you can think of correlates with growing up in a home without a father. And Related to that, although broader than that, is the important. You talked about intermediate institutions and the little platoons. If you would talk about the importance of religion and church and faith in addressing some of the problems that you've identified.
Sure, sure. Well, you know, the question of family structure is, you almost can't say enough about it because of how important it is, and you see it in all the statistics, that obviously the children who grow up and broken families in one form or another have much lower life outcomes. You know, I would encourage us to think about, you know, family structure and viable families in a slightly broader context. And what I mean by that is that, as we know from, you know, a lot of sociological evidence, when that first layer of the family breaks down, either you have an absentee father, you have a mother who's died of a heroin overdose, you know, whatever the case may be, it is in some cases not a perfect substitute, but a much, much better substitute to have grandparents or aunts or uncles in the picture. And I worry that, especially in public policy, we've actually made it harder for that next layer of the family to play a positive role in the lives of some of these children. I think that was certainly my experience growing up. And if you look just at the sheer numbers, I mean, hundreds of thousands of children who are entering the social welfare system for abuse or neglect reasons in some form or another every single year in this country. And those are a disproportionate source of so much of our social problems, that they're a disproportionate source of our addicted population, of our prison population, of our non-working population. And so I do think that we are at a time where we have such remarkable stresses on the families in some of these communities that we have to think a little bit outside the box, and how, if the first level of family falls apart, how can we figure out a way to make sure that the next layer of family is there for as many kids as possible? So I think that's an important thing to think about. But of course, what you want in the ideal situation is for a mom and dad to raise the kids in relative stability. It's just remarkable how infrequently that's happening in our lower income families of all racial and ethnic demographics. You know, the final point that I'll make about that is that, you know, this is something that has been exacerbated by America's opioid crisis. And about half of the foster care children in Ohio right now are in foster care directly because of the opioid crisis. And you have, in the areas where the opioid crisis has hit most intensively, you have an unbelievable stress that's been placed on extended families and also on the foster care systems, because you have thousands of children every year who are orphaned because of what's happening to the parents who get caught up in this stuff. And it's really heartbreaking, but it's also one of these things that if we don't wrap our mind around, I think that the family structure is only going to get more and more stressed over time.
You know, Dean, before you ask the next question, I just wanted to point out, I think there's real strong parallels between J.D.'s book. In this respect, there's very strong parallels between J.D.'s book and another book that's familiar to a lot of our listeners, Justice Thomas's wonderful autobiography, My Grandfather's Son, where Justice Thomas's grandfather plays such an immense role in helping form Justice Thomas's character.
I wanted to press J.D. to talk a little bit more, though, about the second part of my question, which is the role of church and religion and faith, because that's something that I think, you know, would speak to not only the problem of out of wedlock birth, but also you know, substance abuse and other things that are basically a moral catastrophe.
Yeah, absolutely, and I appreciate you following up. Sometimes I can get so long-winded that I'll forget the second part of the question by the time I'm finished answering the first. But, you know, the role of church is something that I spend a fair amount of time on in my book, and, you know, again, in a very personal way, getting involved not just with religion and not just with the Christian faith, but with an institutional church, a place where I went every week and, you know, participated in a lot of the rituals that come along with religious practice. That was really important to me. And if you look at the evidence, it is an incredibly important component of what can go right in the lives of a lot of kids whose situations are going wrong. And so, you know, there's this very interesting paper by Jonathan Gruber where he tries to, you know, look at all of the things that are going on for kids who are participating in regular religious practice. And you see, you know, all the statistics moving in the right direction for reasons that I imagine very few people on this call would be very surprised by. You know, you see lower incarceration rates and higher graduation rates, higher employment rates, higher family stability rates, and so forth. But Gruber actually tries to understand whether this is a causal phenomenon. In other words, whether church or whether active religious participation can be said to be driving those positive impacts and not just sort of on the receiving end of those positive social impacts. And, you know, he finds that religion is actually causally related to a lot of these positive social outcomes. And he's sort of agnostic about why that is. But, you know, my answer to that question is, one, you know, the message of the faith, which I think is very important, and two, the social capital that's created in active religious communities as opposed to, you know, non-active religious communities. It's very easy, of course, to say that you're a religious person, to be a practicing Christian, if you're completely detached from an institution of the faith. But when you're actively participating in a church, you know, that church actually requires things of you. It requires moral adherence to certain tenets. It requires a certain amount of social give and social take when people find themselves on tough times. And I do think that that is just a remarkably important positive contribution, but is unfortunately an important part of why so many things are going in the wrong direction right now. Because, you know, as Charles Murray has written about, as Brad Wilcox has written about in this wonderfully titled paper, No Money, No Honey, No Church, about the decline of work, marriage, and church going among a lot of working class people, he finds that church attendance has fallen off much more steeply among the working class than it has among the middle class and the upper class. And so, unfortunately, at a time when you have a lot of these social indicators moving in the wrong direction, you have participation in church, something that can be a corrective to those social indicators moving in the wrong direction, that church going is actually declining. And so I really worry about that. And I you know, encourage those who are actively involved in a church to find some ways to get their religious community involved in some of the lower income or working class communities in their area, because I think that there's a remarkable amount of good to be done.
That's a great point, Mr. Vance, and I don't want to monopolize things either, but you know, you mentioned Charles Murray, and one of the things that he concludes you know, in his book, you know, Coming Apart, is that, you know, the problem with you know, with our upper classes is not that they don't walk the walk, it's that they don't talk the talk. You know, they don't do enough to you know, they're afraid of appearing to be judgmental. They're afraid of appearing to be, you know, illiberal in some way, and so they don't reach out, you know, to people outside their bubble and say, well, look, you know, this is really, you know, this is really a better way to, you know, to organize your life and to live your life than, you know, than what you're doing. You know, it's not a great idea, you know, to have children out of wedlock. It's not a good idea, you know, to not be working and to be involved in crimes. And it's a good idea to have religious faith.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I think sometimes those who are doing pretty well can be so afraid of moralizing or so uncomfortable with just the day-to-day social engagements that might be necessary with working class or poor Americans, that they don't actually reinvest the social and the human capital that they have. If you think about, you know, birth rates at the top and the fact that these people are cloistering themselves into their own bubbles, I really do worry that these folks have a lot to give and a lot to offer. But unfortunately, they're either too afraid or too unwilling to really participate in some of these communities that really need it.
Thank you very much, Mr. Vance.
Yeah, thank you. Please call me JD.
Okay.
We've still got five questions pending, so let's take another call.
Yeah, thank you. My name is Rod Niner. I read your book, Part of the Federalist Society, and The book really, if anybody hasn't bought it, go out and buy it. It's a must read. And in many respects, our lives almost paralleled each other, except we were fortunate enough not to have as much of the family disruption. Grew up in the bottom 5% economics-wise of the country in a small rural community out in South Dakota. never made more than, you know, family was always way at the bottom of 5%. But we had a, this dovetail to what you said, and I'd like to hear your comments about this. We had an extremely strong church community. There wasn't even a public school there. It was a church school that was subsidized by the greater church donations. And for some reason, I and my two other brothers went on to get cumulatively 6 Ivy League degrees. And we went, now money isn't everything, and by far not everything, but just by way of a metrics, we went from the bottom 5% to the top 1% in one generation. So much of what you said in the book really strings through about the social capital. I remember the first law school interviews. I didn't know what the heck was going on when I went to these, you know, the schools. You know, everybody thought I was, you know, I was taught to be polite, dress as nicely as you can, and be civil, right? And so you go to the Ivy League institutions, and everybody thought I was a rich, preppy person from Connecticut, and I proceeded to learn or be told by all these institutions how the government had to help the poor this way and help the poor this way because they're incapable of doing it themselves. When I pushed back and I said, no, we don't need the government to help. We need our communities to help. The reason we were successful, and this dovetails, is when somebody struggled in the church community, the other people stood up. And this, your book did a very good job, and I understand you didn't want to get too political in the book, but there's so much cry for government do this and government do that. Our place was very close to a Native American reservation, and if you want a good case study on how to destroy families and how to destroy poor people even more than the bad situation that they started in, go look at how the government treats and tries to help the Native American families. And, you know, I think this, the social capital part really has to be emphasized, but maybe not from a government standpoint. Just say, hey, government, get out of the way when these communities are trying to help. If a church wants to do something, if a church school wants to do something, if a private institution wants to do something, encourage it. Don't stop it. And, you know, so many people have asked me and my family, well, how did the three of you come from, you know, a 700-square-foot home with, you know, I didn't even have a bathroom until I was 2 years old, and how did you do that? And they act like it was something weird, you know, and we didn't think it was hard, but we didn't think it was that weird because we had that support and we had confidence. And that just makes me respect JD you even more because, you know, I read your book and you had a great, you had a good extended support with your grandparents, but, you know, it was difficult with your immediate family. And fortunately we didn't have that problem. But I think that without that, we would have never been able to do what we wanted to, and without the community, we wouldn't have done. And frankly, the government, didn't do much else. So I think it just dovetailed to the last question, and I'd just like to hear what you think about that or if you have anything to add or distinguish from that.
Well, sure. Thank you for the question. And, you know, my first of all, I agree with you that a lot of what the government has done has either been ineffective or even counterproductive in trying to help a lot of these communities. You know, my worry here, and this unfortunately doesn't lead me to a fantastic answer, but I do think it leads me to asking a slightly different question than the one that I've heard a lot of folks ask over the past 10 or 15 years is, you know, when I think about what has actually worked in my life, it was, like you mentioned, churches, it was my extended family, it was the Marine Corps. You know, a lot of those things aren't necessarily amenable to policy interventions, and you may not want to intervene from a policy perspective for fear of actually making the problem worse than it already is. But I do think that we have to be asking different questions. And so, you know, your comment points to the question, how might we rebuild social capital among lower income communities? Now, I don't think that is a purely policy driven question. I think that it implicates philanthropists and community groups and churches and even businesses, because of course, one of the most important social institutions in a lot of these communities is the company that a lot of people work at. But I do think that policy has to play some sort of a role, or at least we should be wondering if policy could play a more productive role than it has in the past. Because I think that we're at a point where, you know, as you know, this is something else Charles Murray has written about, but we're at a point where there's the potential that we have a real diversion of outcomes among the top and the bottom. And I don't think this has been quite true yet. Our society hasn't become quite so stratified. But if you just look at the basic set of expectations, the economic opportunities and prospects, the family and community circumstances that people find themselves in, we're at a point where there is a significant subset of the population where they are in some ways trapped in a multi-generational cycle that seems to not be getting any better, in some cases getting worse, despite the fact that we're spending a fair amount of money to correct the problem. So do I think that leads us in a direction where we shouldn't be spending any money on the problem because it's not making it better? No. In fact, I don't think that at all. But I do think that it should lead us in the direction of saying, what would a really outside-the-box approach to some of these issues look like? What would a new approach to some of these problems look like? Because what we've been doing just hasn't been working.
Yeah, no, thank you. And I think also a little bit of it is from the upper middle upper classes, too, is, and this is related to the social capital, and this is just a social thing that's never going to go away and just human nature. But like the struggles you had initially in your book, you know, I and my brothers, we probably suffered them too, in that there's a lot of, you know, it's akin to bigotry a little bit of, oh, you know, you came from a poor hick place and you don't know what's going on and that type of thing. And that, you know, that's just something you have to, it's not that bad of a thing, but you know, your book had a few references to things like that too, and that's it means a lot to know the rules, like you said, figure out the job interview thing. At one point, I don't want to dominate either. Thank you for your book; it's very good.
Thank you, and that's just one really just quick final point to that is that, you know, that actually I think relates a little bit back to this point about whether and how upper-income Americans can be playing a role in some of these communities. And one of those things is that, yeah, we do have to shoot down that anti-hick or anti-low-income bias that doesn't exist among everybody, but it certainly exists among some people. And so, you know, it's definitely something that I saw, and I think that it does serve as a barrier to, you know, upper-income folks passing along some of that social capital.
We've still got four questions pending, but let's try and get to as many of these as possible. Go ahead, caller.
JD, this is Bill Severson out in the Soviet of Seattle. My question for you is, it seems to me your experience is similar, parallel to a lot of the experience probably from families and communities in the Black community. And one of the things that seems to me to be, something we have not figured out, particularly on the more conservative end, a way of taking kind of the kinds of values and ideas you have in terms of, you know, what works, what's important in terms of solving some of these social problems, and figuring out a way of coming up with promoting solutions to that in the Black community. I think it's very difficult for white folks to kind of go in and into a Black community and tell people how to live their lives. I don't think that's going to happen. But I think somebody like you comes from a similar kind of experience is in a position to maybe have a dialogue that many others aren't able to have. And I wonder, it seemed to me that that was maybe in your mind as you wrote your book. I'm curious if you think, you know, how close the parallel is and whether or not your thoughts and prescriptions would apply kind of to people in same sort of economic and social circumstance across race communities.
Well, I agree 100% that there are a lot of parallels, and that's one of the most gratifying experiences of writing the book for me, is just the sheer volume of folks who have come from lower income backgrounds in the Black community who have basically said, in one form or another, this is my story. And so I absolutely think that there are a lot of commonalities there. But, you know, to your point, there are a lot of commonalities, and unfortunately, a lot of the problems that exist in the Black community haven't necessarily gotten a lot better. And, you know, my worry here is that the fundamental conversation of really the past three or four decades has been a sort of a debate between growth or government assistance. And so, you know, those of us on the right, I think, have real, in some cases justifiable, but real faith in the idea that economic growth and opportunity can solve a lot of these social problems. In some cases, that's right. But I think, as we've seen, it's not always right. And then folks on the left have a real faith that if we just did a little bit more or put a little bit more resources into programs that have been out there for a half a century, then these problems would all magically go away. And I think that in some ways that paradigm has really broken down, in the sense that it's not leading us to really long-term, durable solutions to a lot of these problems. And so this is, you know, in some ways what I was getting at with my response to the last question. But I think that we have to start asking new and different questions, because it's very clear to me that, unfortunately, too many on the left are sort of married to the old way of doing things. And I think that if we continue to sort of attach ourselves to the old way of doing things and just saying, you know, if we just get those marginal tax rates a little bit better, if we just get the corporate tax code in a little bit better shape, we'll turn on the engines of growth and all of these things will get better. Well, I think it's really important to turn on the engines of the growth, but I also think that we're probably kidding ourselves if we think that it's going to solve most of the problems of the American underclass. And unfortunately, we've got to solve those problems. I don't think that we have a really durable society if we have so many people on the bottom just replicating multi-generationally the problems that existed in past generations and feeling like they're completely cut off from the opportunities that exist in the broader country.
Yeah, I think that's a huge problem. And the problem with the people on the left is, you know, their policy wants to sort of destroy or limit the effectiveness of all of those intermediary institutions like churches and civic clubs and those sorts of things by controlling them with, you know, direct government takeover, essentially. Whereas I think your book suggests that people like Neil Ferguson suggest, you know, what we need is to revitalize those non-governmental institutions, including even the family, as a way of trying to address some of those issues. But, you know, I hope you think someday about running for office, because I think that you need to be able to make that argument, you need to come from a background where you can speak with authenticity about that across cultures. I think you've got the ability to do that in a unique sort of way, and I don't think sort of normal politicians probably can. And I think that's a vast, just a massively important sort of thing. So somehow we got to do it, because it's a huge problem.
We are just about out of time, but I want to try and get to at least one more question. So I ask the caller to be as concise as possible with your question. Go ahead, caller. You might have your phone on mute. If you've put your phone on mute, you need to come off mute.
Apologies for that. I had. Both my parents were in jail as part of Nixon's early drug war before I was three. So as a result, I grew up in foster care. Until the failed adoption at 11, I had moved out of the house at 15, joined the Marine Corps at 17, lost a bunch of years to bartending and waiting tables, so I learned how to program computers and then went to UVA and graduated from UVA Law School. Looking back, you know, I needed those government programs. I needed Head Start. I needed that fourth grade teacher that took me to the middle school science fair. You know, I just want to press back a little bit against what the last guy said and evidently what the thesis of your book is. Back in the 60s, before the Great Society programs, we had 10,000 kids dying each year in slums and tenements from complications associated with rat bites. We don't have that anymore. So to a certain extent, some of these poverty programs have worked. And what I came through my experience with is a whole lot more of we're all in this together than we are all rugged individuals. Because there are a lot of kids like you and I that needed help from outside the family. One of the things I was wondering about as you went through your discussion today is how much you underestimate the blessing of your own superior intelligence, your own conscience, your own EQ. For a kid to understand exactly what he had to say to the cops to make sure that his life ended up a little bit better. I mean, if you had bad EQ, you might have been attention-seeking and telling the cops whatever you needed for attention at that time. So what I'm thinking is that a lot of these problems folks are seeing in society, it's because the folks I'm hearing being judged on this phone call don't have an IQ in the upper 1 or 2%. Or maybe they don't have a conscience similar to yours and mine. I mean, I'm raising a couple of kids now that are in advanced academic placement programs out in McLean, Virginia. I've done really well, but I didn't do it without help. Another question I have is how much of it is culture? I mean, the Bible Belt is where you're finding the concentrations of divorce and out of wedlock birth and lack of education. You find Silicon Valley and Wall Street and the economic engines of America on the coasts in the liberal states. That's where you had pre-college in California for years and years and years. So I'm wondering if you've actually grappled with the other side, the flip side to your coin, because I think we both exist in the same world in very many of the same ways, but we've come to different conclusions, and I'm wondering why.
Well, thanks for that question, and I'll try to be as rapid as I can here, but there's a lot there, and I may not get to it all of it. So the very first thing is that I don't think that anything, at least that I've heard and the questioner is asking, and certainly it's not my thesis, that the anti-poverty programs of the 1960s have been abject failures. They have made it so that fewer people starve to death. They've made it so that fewer people grow up in just abject poverty in the way that you mentioned. But have they been effective at really transplanting a large segment of the American underclass into more and greater economic opportunities? There's just a little bit of an echo. Maybe you could mute your phone while I'm – I think maybe there's a feedback of it. But so have they been effective at promoting upward mobility and greater economic opportunity? I don't think so. And more importantly, I think that we've reached the point of diminishing returns at this point, in the sense that very many of the public programs that we spend on today, they are not producing more upward mobility. They're not producing more children who are getting educations. They're not producing more stable families. They're not producing more people who are working in stable jobs. And so it's not that that we should sort of pull the proverbial rug from underneath people and completely eliminate the anti-poverty programs of the 1960s. It's that I think we should recognize that we've reached a point where those programs have done the good that they're doing, and we need to be thinking about other things. We need to be thinking about other ways to accomplish social goals, whether they're through policy or not through policy, because I just don't see the argument that if we keep on, let's say, if we raise the amount of public expenditures on this or that program, that somehow we're not going to have many, many children trapped in the bottom. I think that the experience of the past 40 or 50 years is that our anti-poverty programs have been good at promoting subsistence, which is obviously important, but it's not been good at promoting movement between multiple classes of Americans. So I'll sort of say that, and that's one argument that I make. And then there were other things there, but you know, my fundamental argument here is in some ways that the left-right paradigm, as we've discussed it for the past 40 or years, just doesn't necessarily work to the social problems that exist. Economic growth is important. Preventing people from starving to death is important. I don't want to eliminate either of those things, but it's weird to me that in a society where a lot of these social trends have continued to move in the wrong direction, despite in some cases increased public expenditures, that we're still having the same debate that I feel like maybe we were having in the 1960s or 1970s. I think that we have to get beyond that a little bit. Now, on your point about culture, what I mean when I talk about culture, and I unfortunately think that culture is very often layered with a lot of moral blame, but when I talk about culture, what I mean is that the way that we grow up, the things that we see, the attitudes and habits that we develop in our communities, they continue to affect us. If you saw, for example, childhood trauma growing up, the evidence is that you're much more likely to engage in subjecting your children to childhood trauma when you're older. If you come from an unstable family, the evidence is overwhelming that completely independent of income, you're more likely to expose your family to instability later on. And so, you know, if you grow up in an environment that's very hopeless, where there aren't a whole lot of people making it through or doing especially well, the evidence is pretty solid that those attitudes start to have an effect on you and start to motivate in some ways the ways that you move through the world. And so when I talk about culture, that's what I mean. And so that culture can exist among, you know, lower income Americans in the Bible Belt, just as it can exist among lower income or working class Americans in San Francisco or in Utah or wherever else. And the evidence that I've seen suggests that when you look at things like elevated rates of divorce, elevated rates of childhood trauma, elevated rates of concentrated poverty, which is, you know, sort of gets back to this question of hopelessness and being surrounded by despair, that those things are most intense in the industrial Midwest, in the Southeast, and the Appalachian regions of the country, urban and rural areas, all across that broad region. And the evidence, again, is I think that culture replicates itself. Now, you know, some of that area is touching the Bible Belt, but as I said earlier, even within those areas, lower income Americans aren't going to church as much. So I don't think that it's quite right to blame religion for these problems. If anything, I think we'd want to blame the fact that too few people are participating in traditional religious institutions. But the final point that I'll make to just sort of sum all this up is that I'm not arguing, and if I gave that impression, then I apologize, that policy doesn't have a role or that 1960s anti-poverty policy was ineffective. I think what it has is reached a point of diminishing returns where we need to be rethinking what it is that we're doing, why we're doing it, and whether the public money that we're spending is actually accomplishing the goals that we set out to accomplish. Does that answer your question? Is that a good place to stop?
I will answer for him. This is Dean Reuter. I'm afraid his phone has been muted, so I don't think we're going to hear further from him. But we have a couple questions pending, but we're out of time. I apologize to our audience that we're going to have to leave it right there. But let me come back to Adam White one more time and see if he has a final thought here. Adam?
No, I've enjoyed the conversation and all the good questions that the audience had. I'd encourage people to look up what JD is doing now in Ohio. I think it's very interesting and a great application of the themes you find in his book. But in the meantime, be sure to buy the book and read it. And JD's not paying me to say that. I'm just a big fan of the book.
Once again, the title of the book is Hillbilly Elegy. The author, J.D. Vance, as Adam White suggested, available at Amazon and booksellers everywhere. I want to thank you both, Adam White and J.D. Vance. This has been a fabulous discussion. I want to thank the audience as well for dialing in for their questions as well. A reminder to the audience that our next scheduled telephone call, 1 p.m. Eastern Time on Thursday. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.